where strategy gaming meets good vibes. No stress, just critical moves. So welcome back to Critical Moves. Today, my best mate Tim and I are joined by Brandon Castile, who is the lead game designer on the upcoming RTS, Tempest Rising. And with the release date just around the corner, these are exciting times. You're actually living the dream, aren't you, Brandon?
Yeah, I tell people if I am actually dreaming, don't wake me up. Let me sleep a little longer to let it play out.
So don't pinch you.
Yeah, don't pinch me.
Okay. Well, we can't. We're too far away, but you're free from pinching. Brandon, so Tempest Rising is one of a handful of RTS titles currently in development, with others like Sanctuary, Shattered Sun, Zero Space, and Dwarf as well. So just to get us started, do you think we are in the midst of an RTS revival?
I'm going to be a little controversial on this, and I think that every time a couple RTS start coming out, people start getting their hopes up about a hypothetical RTS revival. And then people build up these games to be something that they aren't supposed to be, that the creators of the games aren't intending. And then they get disappointed, even if the games aren't disappointing. So I'm always hesitant to talk about that sort of a thing. I think we were lucky enough in 2019 and early 2020 to get a bunch of publishers who were willing to take a chance on this genre. And I think it's really great that we're seeing a bunch of RTS. That's what I will say. I think it's great to see all of these people who are very passionate about this genre getting a chance to make the games that they love. And even in the last year or two, we have MicroProse coming back, and they're doing a lot of like really small, independent RTS projects like Dying Breed and Strategos. They just announced one today. Yep. There's another one called Flying Squid, and we're pre-recording this, but on the 27th of March, an RTS called Modu-War that's been in development for like 5 or 6 years. They finally got a publisher in Flying Squid. So we're definitely in a place where RTS are proving that they can be viable and that they can make money for the developers and the publishers who are making them. And I think that's really great to see. And I'm really happy that we get to be a part of that too.
And MicroProse seem to have their fingers in all the pies, don't they?
They have been all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they're driving this, if it is or whether it isn't a revival, that every single strategy game that I see coming out seems to have MicroProse all over it, with the exception of Tempest Rising, of course, which is 3D Realms.
We've had a interesting situation with publishers. 3D Realms has always been one of the publishers, and we're also with Saber. So what happened is when we started working on Tempest Rising, we were with THQ Nordic, and then both THQ Nordic and Slipgate got picked up by different companies, and those companies got picked up by Embracer. And it ended up kind of being realigned within Embracer, and then the whole Embracer situation happened. And when Saber went independent, they took us with them. Basically, that's the story of that.
Lots of changes.
And I'm really glad that we finally get to come out of this at the end of that crazy journey. They say that it's a wonder that any game ever gets made because of all the stuff that happens behind the scenes and all the funding woes and development issues and all of that. It's crazy that any game ever comes out at all.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about Tempest Rising then. It has this, I would describe it as a future modern military aesthetic.
Like a retro futurism or cassette futurism is another term, especially with one of our factions, the Tempest Dynasty. They have a real like 1980s, 1990s aesthetic to their technology. You got a lot of big clunky devices with like Star Wars style, with like the line art, like really big pixels on all their stuff. Yeah. And that was just, we always, the team really liked that aesthetic. And we wanted an excuse to use it, basically. And I think it turned out really well, especially, again, for our Tempest Dynasty faction that kind of really leans into that.
It's like set in the future of the past.
Right. So the story of Tempest Rising is that in the 1960s, the Cuban Missile Crisis went nuclear. It started World War III. There was a violent but brief nuclear exchange. And in the wake of that, you know, you had people starting to rebuild. And in the late 60s and early 70s, this electrical plant starts growing all over the place. One of the terms we've used for it is like electrical kudzu. I don't know if you guys have that in England, but where I live, the forests got overtaken by this creeper called kudzu. It's like a vine. And it was like hanging over all the trees and stuff. And the state government had to spend years cutting it back and getting rid of it. And in fact, that's what happened in our story, is this plant starts growing and it's coming up out of the nuclear craters and it's covering houses and stuff. And for a while, they're just burning it back and trying to get rid of it. And then they realize it's basically an infinite source of electricity. And they go from trying to get rid of it to actively cultivating it all over the world, because it's, you know, you don't have to worry about power plants or anything. You just get a big vat of this electrical juice and you can power anything you want. So we have this interesting situation where vast areas of the world are still being slowly rebuilt or still, you know, piles of rubble. But you also have this incredible energy renaissance going on, thanks to this miracle plant called Tempest. And of course, that's a that's a play on words, because a tempest is a storm. And the idea is that this electrical vine is like a, you know, like a growing thunderstorm on the ground. So in the wake of this, and this is all just the history behind the setting, this group called the Global Defense Force, they arise primarily out of US and parts of Europe and South America. And they are positioning themselves as a peacekeeping force. They say, look, you know, the humans fighting caused all this. We're going to make sure that nothing like this happens again. So they start taking over governments and setting down rules that all these, you know, old world powers have to follow. And as a response to this, this other group called the Tempest Dynasty forms, and it's an alliance of a lot of primarily Western European and Asian nations. And they say, no, you can't nuke us and then tell us what to do. We want to control ourselves. And they align under this war hero named Domovoy Molchalin. And he's the one that actually creates the Tempest Dynasty. And it's actually run by his son, so it's really actually dynastic in the game. But that's pretty much kind of where the game sets off, is you have these two world powers who have very different visions of what this plant is and how the world should be governed. And they start getting into territorial conflicts and power grabs and with, you know, machinations going on in the background. And of course, I don't know if you guys have seen the trailers, but there's a whole other element to that shows up in the campaign as well.
Yeah. That looks really exciting. And I actually really like how it's a bit more than like, oh, there's this random mysterious ore laying around. It has like proper story to it and a setting. And I actually really like that.
I think we did an episode not so long ago about storytelling in strategy games. And I think that often it can be missed that you need to give people a reason to want to play. And I guess the philosophy behind this is that you've almost got a situation where you could have a post-scarcity society when you've got unlimited energy. But humanity just isn't ready to be friends. They just want to fight each other all the time. But that's human nature. It's human history, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you have questions of who owns, who controls this resource, and who's allowed to use it, and where on the world are they going to be, you know, setting up these giant farms of vines. So yeah, there's definitely some interesting implications. And what's really important to me as a designer is what I call throughput. So you have a lot of RTS games that were created, and someone had an idea for a game they wanted to play. and they put in, okay, well, we got to have a rifle soldier, and we got to have a missile soldier, and we got to have a tank, and the tank's got to be a tank. And in the end, it doesn't create something memorable or interesting. You know, there's a lot of games out there that you don't really feel a good connection to the world and to the systems or the factions. And what we tried to do with Tempest Rising is have a lot of throughput. So the Tempest resource isn't just something to fight over. It's not like, I don't want to pick on StarCraft because it's a phenomenally popular game, but minerals in StarCraft, in the first game, they actually have a bit of story behind it. It's in the manual. You can go and read kind of what minerals are and why they're important. But that's really just, it never comes up in the game at all. Minerals are just a thing and they give you money. With Tempest, it's a part of the story. It's a part of the mechanical systems of the game. The Tempest plant is incredibly volatile, and vehicles moving through it jostle the pods around, and they can crush the vines, and that releases an electrical energy. And so vehicles moving through Tempest actually build up kind of like a static charge that we call Tempest charge, and it slows them down. It slows them, their move speed and their attack speed progressively the longer they're in contact with Tempest. Eventually, it builds up to the point where it overflows. And when it overflows, it starts doing really quick damage to whatever it's affecting. And now you could be saying, you know, well, we'll just not put our vehicles on top of Tempest and then we're fine. And we thought of that. The factions have learned to weaponize this. So there's a couple of units on each faction that can actually produce this effect as an attack. In fact, one of the GDF, they have an artillery unit called the Trebuchet. It's one of their higher tier ground units. And its attacks produce Tempest Charge. So even if you're not walking your vehicles across fields of this stuff, you can still have it inflicted on you by your enemy. And then from there, and this is the throughput, we build layers on that. So there's the resource, it has influence on the story, and then it has mechanical systems that are related to it. And we have units that interact with it in various ways. It's completely benign to infantry. The idea being that as they walk through it, they can step over the vines or walk around it. They're not, you know, rolling, pushing through it like tanks have to. So they're completely immune to it. So you can hide your infantry in fields of Tempest to protect them from vehicles. And that's another thing I want to go into at some point, is in a lot of games like this, infantry are something that you get early in the game because you have to. And then, you know, mid-game, you're switched over to flame tanks and regular tanks, and your infantry are something that you might get maybe as a side thing if you're trying to do a sneaky special strategy. And why even have infantry at that point? There's a lot of, like, Command & Conquer games where there's just no point in building infantry past 4 or 5 minutes into the game unless you're trying to do some sneaky strategy. And what we wanted to do was make infantry really important. So that's one of the ways we're trying to make infantry important, is they can do things like hide in these fields of stuff that tanks just don't want to go into. But anyway, I'm talking in circles here a little bit. I'm sorry. I get really excited about this stuff.
Please. don't apologize. It's very interesting stuff. So if you feel passionate about it, we love to hear it.
But anyway, so we have some vehicles that are completely immune to Tempest. They have Tempest shielding. Dynasty has some vehicles that will accrue Tempest charge, but can't be affected by the overflow effect. And we actually have a vehicle that will consume Tempest charge. It gets affected by it, but it will consume it on itself to heal itself. So you can actually roll over it, get the debuff, but then you heal over time at the end of it.
And did I understand that correctly? The Trebuchet, does it if you stand in a Tempest, will it fire better or stronger?
Oh, no. So it's attacks inflict Tempest charge on enemy vehicles. So it's kind of like a moving debuffer. But if you have a couple of them, they'll really quickly stack up that Tempest charge, and then they'll be doing a bunch of bonus damage because of the overflow effect. And they have a weapon called the Searchlight Sensor. And what the Searchlight Sensor does is it literally just inflicts Tempest charge in a cone. So when it's attacking, it just this big cone of enemy vehicles that'll inflict Tempest charge on.
Is that the one we see in the trailer that he throws a grenade that's on fire?
I don't know which trailer you're talking about, but I don't remember. I think that's just the Grenadier unit, the big chunky guy that throws a grenade. Grenadier. And he just, he's actually important because his weapons will attack enemy infantry inside of garrisons. We have garrison buildings that could be out on the map, and they protect your infantry from most weapons, but there's a couple of weapons that'll damage them while they're inside of the garrison. And that's one of his roles.
So when I've been looking into you and into Tempest Rising, so that you joined 3D Realms in around 2020, that you joined the company 2019, 2020, and Tempest Rising was already in development at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. So I was brought on as a part of a focus group. So they had a group of developers that had worked on a couple of games together, and they felt like it was the right time to start making the game. And they did, I think, what's a really great habit to do in when you're pitching a game is they did what's called building a beautiful corner or a vertical slice. So they prototyped some units, they prototyped some buildings so they could show off, this is base building, this is what we want the combat to kind of look and feel like. So there were a couple of things that already existed when I was brought into the game. But yeah, so I think I was a part of the focus group in mid to late 2019. And then when the game was picked up, they brought me on as the lead game designer. And so I guess they liked my contributions to the focus group.
And that was really what I wanted to ask, because as the lead game designer for a game which was already in development, how much influence have you had on this final product?
So one of the first things I did is I took their existing game design documentation and I kind of finished it. One thing that's really important to me personally when you're working on a design for anything, because I've also done graphic design and web design, knowing the target you're shooting for is very important. It's really easy to get caught up in, oh, well, what if we did this cool thing? What if we did that cool thing? This is a great idea. And you can't evaluate whether or not it's good for your product unless you know exactly what you're making. So the first thing I did when I was brought into the game is I created a foundational set of pillars for what we were trying to make and what we were trying to do. And you can use those to say, okay, we've got this great idea, but does it match up with what we're trying to make? Does it match up with our design philosophy, with our design pillars? So there were, I think, 5 or 6 units, a couple of buildings that already existed. It was pretty easy to work those in to to my vision for what I wanted these factions to be and how I wanted the game to work. There were some things that existed that I had to try to find how to use them, because we didn't want to waste the money in doing the animations and doing the modeling and all of that stuff. So more of the Dynasty faction I had direct influence on than the GDF, but I would say probably 80 to 85% of the units in the GDF were from me, and then 90 plus for the Dynasty. But if the way I like to think about it, or the way I like to say it in kind of a humorous way, is if the game isn't fun, it's probably my fault. I designed the tech trees.
Do you have an email address? Do you have an email address we can send all the complaints to?
Why would you need email? You just go on Twitter, don't you? And or Reddit, yeah, and you just dump it all on there.
On Discord. but no, in all seriousness, I designed a lot of the unit stats. The tech trees are all on me. The combat pacing, the abilities. And, you know, I didn't hand code them, but they were coded to the patterns that I wrote. So I would say I had a lot of influence on how the game plays in a minute-by-minute basis. I set up the toolkit, and then we have a phenomenal team of level designers and the poor programmers that had to write the stuff that I directed. But I mean, obviously it's a team effort. So one of the things that I had to had to become more comfortable with as the development went on is it's not my job to have good ideas. You know, I'm not the only person in the company that can have a good idea about what can happen in the game. So as the designer, as a designer, it's really easy to say, you know, I've got the best ideas. I know what's going on. I want, you know, everything to go my way. And being able to have the humility to say, well, this is a good idea and it comes from a valued source and we want to bring it in. And conversely, if there's something I want to do, to be able to say, you know, this isn't working the way I thought it would, or it's working the way I thought it would, but it doesn't have the effect that I was hoping it would have. And being able to say, okay, we'll do this a different way. You know, what's better for the game rather than what's better for my ego. That was something that I had to grow into, I think, a little bit. Mm.
Did you have some like really difficult decisions to make where it was like, oh, we kind of want this, but we also wanted that, but they're not compatible with each other?
I would say that as a designer, what I try to do is take restrictions and turn them into strengths. I think some of the best systems that we have came from things I was completely unable to do. And I don't want to tell you what those things are because I feel like they're strong and they're good. And I don't want to put those things in a different light. But there were a lot of things that we went and we batted around when we were in pre-production. For instance, one easy example for me is the Tempest Dynasty have an ability on their power plants. So normally in a game like this, you build power plants and that gives you power that you spend to produce other structures. So if I build a barracks, the barracks might consume 20 power. If I build a tech center, the tech center might consume 80 power. So I have to keep building power plants to be able to continue expanding my base and my economy. The dynasty can take their power plant and they can turn it off by producing an effect called distribution mode. And what that does is it makes all turrets and factories near that power plant attack faster or produce units faster. But it also damages them over time. So you kind of have this window where you're better, but you have to, you know, pay to repair your turrets or to repair your factories. So the dynasty, how I like to talk about their economies, you got these big levers that you're pulling. You know, I turn distribution mode on and I can make units faster. Then I have to turn it off. And I can turn something else on and it makes something else better. But then I've got to turn that off to do something else. So the dynasty is they've got this big machine that they're driving with these big levers that they're pulling. And all that to say that originally I was going to have the GDF turn off their power plant to do something else. And we ended up deciding that that felt more like something the dynasty would do. So I've had systems that I wanted to implement that didn't work out. And I've had things, you know, work in a way that wasn't expected. And we've kind of moved stuff around. But I think that's all in pursuit of having the most interesting game. But one of the GDF's big systems, they have a system called Intel, which is a separate resource that they spend on high tier units and powerful abilities. That came from one of our programmers. You know, we were talking about all the different things that the factions could do. And they suggested this big list of things. And one of them really stuck out to me. And I was like, okay, you know what? This sounds like a really great idea. And we ended up implementing that into our Intel system.
That is something that's quite cool, I feel like, and something that we talked about before is asymmetry in factions. High asymmetries is always a very, very fun thing to see, and Tempest Rising definitely seems to hit that mark.
It's very important to me as a player of real-time strategy games. One of my favorite RTS, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, it's called Universe at War. Petroglyph created it, and it came out in 2007, and it had some of the most extreme asymmetry ever seen in an RTS. One of the factions is called the Hierarchy, and their factories, quote-unquote, is a giant walker, like a War of the Worlds tripod walker. I think they had four legs, but in Universe at War. But you could build hard points on them, and they could actually crush your opponent's buildings by stepping on them, so you could literally walk your base on top of your opponent's base. And then the Novus, they could teleport their units to this network that they build, and the Masari can, you know, they have a hero that can like sell your opponent's units out from under them, and they can give themselves force fields, but then they can't have flying units. And they had some of the most incredible asymmetry in that game. And as a player, I think that's really cool because it can get kind of boring if you're playing these factions. And if you pick faction A, it doesn't really feel that different from picking faction B. To me, it's really interesting to be able to have all of these unique strengths and weaknesses that you have to deal with. And we swung pretty hard for that with Tempest Rising. That's actually one of the things I think makes Tempest Rising so special is with a lot of modern RTS, you have these kind of safe patterns that developers will go into. And it's, you know, we want to not have too many units because we want to make sure that all the units have unique roles. And that's a great goal. But in Tempest Rising, we wanted to go with a more classic approach, like a mid-90s, early 2000s approach, like the Wild West. We want to give you a ton of units. We want to give you five turrets per faction. You know, a lot of modern RTS will give you one or two turret types, and it's more interesting to have five. It's more interesting to be able to make these choices and say, you know, this turret is better for this situation, or I just like this turret, so I'm going to build it more. And I think, you know, over time, we'll have to to make sure that all of our, we have 25, about 25 units per faction. Over time, we'll have to make sure that they all have their own niche and roles. But I think we've got a strong start with that coming out the gate.
It's actually really funny that you say that, because in the trailer, it says present day 1997. And I have a whole lot of wonderful things to say about Tempest Rising. And I wanted to first say the nice things before what I'm about to say. But it does feel a bit like it was released in 1997 in the terms of the gameplay mechanics, I guess, the very basic gameplay mechanics. Obviously, there's a huge amount of beautiful work that's done when it comes to the mechanics of... I'm saying something like, if you build your structure and you can only build it so far from your base, my goodness, you've added a line that says where you can build it. Like, quality of life improvements is immense, and I appreciate that immensely. But when it comes to the core game, I guess it's a game that probably appeals very much to our generation, that we've played these kind of games like a lot. And they're tons of fun. But it is our generation kind of game, I would say. And it doesn't feel like a modern game, other than these immensely appreciated quality of life improvements.
On that point, that's the difficulty here that Brandon and the team have had to face. It's striking the balance between staying true to the foundations of those classic RTS games, but also modernizing the game with mechanics and presentation for a 2025 audience. And that must have been quite central to your thought process, Brandon, when you were looking at making this game. Because I hate when people say it's a love letter to this and it's a homage to this or this. It's your game, and you can see clear influences, but and it's fantastic that they're in there. But you've also, you want to make it accessible and relevant to today's audiences. So how difficult was that to be true to the originals, but also create something new as well?
So one thing I say a lot, both in interviews and internally, and one of the core pillars of our design is, if you give someone the same thing they've already gotten somewhere else, they're going to go get that thing somewhere else. So yes, while I feel like we wanted to truly create a game that, I mean, if you create something for everyone, you're creating it for no one. Our core audience, true. Our core audience is people like us who remember these games. That's exactly what we were trying to do. That's the audience we wanted to serve. It's us. I've said this before, and I happily say this again and again. I'm making the game that I want to play. And I feel phenomenally...
Yeah, it does end up being the best game, so I'll be honest with you.
I feel like I'm phenomenally lucky that I got to make a game that appeals to me. I have hundreds of hours in this game, and not just because I'm in there, you know, hunting bugs or testing something. I play because I want to. I play it in my own time because I want to play it. And sure, again, you know, I'm biased. I'm I have a stake in this game, but I truly am. We are truly making a game that the people that are making it believe in and like to play. And I think that's important. You know, we didn't look at a spreadsheet and analyze market trends. We said, and this is something that Slipgates and 3D Realms have tried to do traditionally, is they want to make the games that they want to play as people. And that's how I feel like Tempest Rising ties into the rest of the Slipgate and 3D Realms lineup. But yeah, I feel like we were phenomenally lucky to be able to just make a game that we just wanted to make, and it was really cool. And the publisher agreed with us that it was really cool. So when you say, I think in a way to say that, you know, maybe that you don't feel anything new or impressive, we aren't trying to redefine the genre. We're trying to take the genre back to its roots. You know, there's a lot of RTS that are out there that are like, we're trying to make the new thing, the new brand of RTS. And I think there's a lot of people out there that don't want a new brand of RTS. They want something that reminds them of the RTS that they played when they were kids. And I was at DreamHack Atlanta last year, and you know what? We actually had a lot of families come back and play the game over and over again. We had dads there with like 10-year-old kids. My kids were there playing, and we had two teenagers that were siblings, and they spent the whole event like sparring with each other. And the sister would win and the brother would win. And I had like a 2-hour conversation with the dad who was there as a part of, I forget what group. I think he did like an educational videos thing. And he was there with a bunch of people for his organization for like teaching people programming. But they spent like half the conference just fighting against each other in our PvP. And it was great. It was great to see teenagers just resonate with these things. I don't feel like we have to have the next new big genre defining system. We just have to take what works and do it well. And that's really what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and before I say any other mean stuff to you, dear guest of ours, I do want to mention that the game looks gorgeous. Anyone at home listening that hasn't somehow lived in a cave and hasn't looked at the game yet, it looks gorgeous. The sound design, my goodness, even the weapons, the unit reactions and so on, they feel crisp, they feel gratifying. When your units shoot, it's like, oh my goodness, I want them to shoot more just to hear them shoot.
One thing we did that I deeply appreciate is as units fire, the barrels of the guns heat up. They start turning red and getting hot, and they start getting like heat distortion effects on it. And I was blown away the first time I saw that in the game. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, that's something that I feel like Tempest Rising is a whole bunch of coolness. Like, I feel like you guys have designed something just to be cool, and I appreciate that. And as much as there's some aspect of it, I'm like, oh, this is such an old game, but it's very cool. A lot of coolness packed into it.
I really appreciate that. That's definitely something we went out of our way to try to do is rule of cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted to do things that were cool to look at, that felt cool to watch. That's another thing that I feel like I wanted to take a swing with. Is and this is a joke. I don't want these people to take this literally, but I often say that the line from The Incredibles, you know, when everyone's super, no one will be. When everything's OP, nothing is. Now that's obviously not true, but we wanted to have a lot of big effects, big impacts. You know, the GDF have a unit called the Riot Trooper. It's a tier 2 infantry. He has a weapon called the EMP grenade that completely shuts down a vehicle when he attacks it. And why is this balanced? Well, because the Tempest Dynasty have the Tempest Sphere, which crushes everything smaller than itself. So you have these very powerful attacks and very powerful defenses, and players are able to, and we've had, you know, during our multiplayer demo, we had a tournament, and there were a couple of rules. You know, we had some balance to work out, but honestly, you know, people had a lot of fun watching it and playing it. And we are taking note of the stuff that was a little overtuned and trying to look at it. But yeah, we thought that my perspective is fun first, and then we can worry about making it fair over time. And we've had a couple of years to work on trying to get that sorted out. And I feel like we're not, you know, obviously balance is always a moving target. You know, Blizzard has been balancing StarCraft 2 for 13 years or something, 15 years now. Good Lord. but I think we're going to start in a decent place with our launch.
I think that there's two ways to balance it. Is one is like, oh, this is too strong, we need to make it smaller. Oh, this is too strong. And then there's like, oh yeah, they have something really strong. Well, the other ones are also going to get something really strong.
Yeah, so I feel like we have got what we're trying to do is give people a lot of interesting things to work with and interact with, and and if something feels strong to use, it's gratifying.
It's fun. Yeah.
Right. So we try to do a lot of stuff like that. There's some of those easy examples were the Tempest Sphere and the Riot Trooper, but there's a lot of other stuff like that in the game.
So on the subject of other stuff, there's a couple of things I'd like to cover that I've played the demo. I've been looking into the game. I'm 47 years old. Red Alert was one of the first games I played in 1996, and absolutely loved it. And when I first played Tempest Rising, the demo, which is probably at some point last year, I said, this is what I wish Command & Conquer had been, if that makes sense. This is the game that I wanted Command & Conquer to be, because all of those fun things that you mentioned, all of those rule of cool things that you mentioned, that just really, you know, 20-year-old me really appreciated that. Or was it 19? I think it was 19 at the time. Really appreciated that. And so 47-year-old me was like, this is what I wanted to play back then. So it's going to hit different people in different ways. My generation, as Tim rightly points out, this is exactly the kind of thing which is going to resonate with us, because it's like a warm blanket or a comfy old pair of shoes. It just feels good, you know. And I think it's absolutely commendable that you've said, I'm going to build a game from the heart, from what I want to play. And you've kind of done it, and it's fantastic. And to hell with anybody who says this is too old or whatever, because it's fantastic and it appeals. But there's a couple of things that really stood out, and one of them was the specialists. So they're not commando units, and they're not infantry either, are they? Can you talk us through the specialists and give us an example of some of your favorite ones?
Yeah, absolutely. So where the specialists came from is, if you play Command & Conquer and you get the commando and you can blow up a building in one shot, or you play Red Alert 2 and you have Tanya and you can kill infantry, you can machine gun down infantry in one shot. I think that's awesome. That's fun. That's really cool. And I like that sort of thing. But in a game like Command & Conquer, you get one. They're at the end of the tech tree, and that's it. And you hardly ever see them in multiplayer. You get them maybe in a couple of missions in single player. And I want more of that. And that's exactly where it came from. So the other thing I really like is in something like Warcraft 3, you have these tier 2 infantry, like for the allies, they have the priest and the sorceress, and then that's where Polymorph comes in and Inner Fire. And then you have the orc shaman with, you know, the Berserker Rage and the lightning shield. And I like that too. So I wanted to create something. And now there's these big stumbling blocks in a lot of RTS. Like Warcraft 3 is a great game. It's a phenomenal game. I always struggled with it because the whole game revolves around your hero. You've got to level up the hero. You've got to feed them experience. You've got to get them items. And it makes the gameplay very complex. And when your hero dies, there's a lot of multiplayer games in Warcraft 3. When the hero dies, the player quits. They fed their enemy too much experience. They can't come back from their hero dying. That's not fun to me. That's really frustrating. So I wanted to create a unit that kind of reminded me of a commando and kind of reminded me of a hero, but wasn't either thing. The specialist is part hero, part commando, kind of. And we have two kinds. There's the tier 2 specialist that they come out fairly early in the game, and they're combat support units. Not support like a healer, like you think of in MMO games or like team shooters, your support is a healer. But in military parlance, the combat support is something like an artillery piece, or, you know, there's other things that combat support means besides just healing things. You have a bunch of choices that you can make in what kind of specialists you want to bring into the field. So the Tempest Dynasty, they have a specialist called the Machinist. He's actually one of my favorites. He has a repair area around himself. He just passively repairs any vehicle that he's standing next to. And then he has a weapon called the Voltaic Spark Gun. And whenever he shoots something with that, if he shoots a building, it just turns it off. So he can shoot an enemy factory, and then they can't make tanks anymore. And that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing to the unit. You just make sure that he's in your army. He's repairing your tanks. You point him at the right thing. He shuts it off. He can swap weapons. He can switch over to the sensor array, and that inflicts Tempest Charge on enemy vehicles, debuffs your enemy army. You switch him back, his Voltaic Spark Gun, when he attacks something with it, if it has Tempest Overflow, it instantly dies. He's the only unit in the game that can both inflict Tempest Charge and also instantly kill units that are affected by the Tempest Overflow effect. It's not a complex unit to use. All you really have to do is have him in your army, and he makes your army better. But if you use him well, you can get a lot of mileage out of him. And that's the sort of design I want in Tempest Rising. I call it opt-in complexity. There are a lot of things that you can just build it and it makes your army better. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about microing it. But if you want to, you can, and you can get extra mileage out of it. And I think that's really important for both people who want to go in and be, you know, sweaty tryhards and do all the micro tricks, but also people who just want to go in and have a good time and not have to worry about having, you know, 102 APM to just play the game. So that's kind of the summary of what a specialist is. It's kind of a commando. It's kind of a hero. It's there to support your army. We have a sniper. She can stealth. When she attacks out of stealth, she actually does double damage or four times damage. I forget which, but it's a lot of extra damage anyway. We have a riot medic. He can shut off enemy infantry's ability to attack in a cone. And then he can place a healing turret that doesn't exactly make your infantry invincible, but it certainly feels that way when you use it. But he can make it for a short period of time, he can make it very, very hard to take out an infantry force. And then the Tempest Dynasty, they have a guy called the Line Officer, and he has an ability. You can load him into a vehicle, and it maxes out that vehicle's veterancy. And then when the vehicle dies, he just pops right back out of it. But he can also inspire troops in nearby. He basically gives a cheer, and they all move and attack faster for a little while. So for him, you're either putting him in a tank to make it really good, or you're boosting your infantry army. You can use them either way. And neither way is super complex to interact with.
It's quite interesting, this, and I know you mentioned right at the start about making sure that infantry remain relevant. Two episodes ago, we covered mm-hmm. Broken Arrow, which is a, you've probably heard about it. It looks excellent. And that, we feel in some ways that was missold because it was sort of their infantry would be used for, you know, to clear buildings and have a real central role to the game, and eventually infantry just got replaced because I could stick a group of tanks and artillery and just blow buildings up rather than send infantry in. But it seems like you've put a lot of thought into making sure that infantry remain relevant, and I really like that. That was absolutely a conscious decision.
Again,
wasn't
it's one
it?
Of the core pillars of my design. I don't want to have a bunch of stuff that there's no point for it to be in the game. So we talked earlier about Tempest fields and how the vines can protect infantry. Infantry actually deal proportionally more damage than tanks. Now, an infantry costs like 200 resources. You know, your regular rocket trooper costs 200 or 300 resources, or your cheapest tank costs like 900. So obviously the tank is going to do more damage. But at cost, let's say your tank costs 900 resources and your rocket infantry costs 300. Three rocket infantry are going to do more damage than one tank. Of course, one tank is going to have more hit points than those three rocket infantry and can roll over them and crush them. And that's where counterplay comes into it. But we wanted it to be worthwhile to train infantry. Again, in a lot of games like this, like where you've got artillery that can shoot, you know, literally a mile and it can blow up, you know, a whole squad of guys, it makes it harder to sell, you know, why you would want to have that squad of guys instead of another artillery piece. What I wanted to do is, if I'm going to make a mistake, I want to make the opposite mistake. where I want infantry to be so powerful that you're like, maybe we need other ways to deal with them. And then again, from there, you can walk it back. But basically what we wanted is, you're taking a risk making infantry. Making infantry is a lot of damage, but it's really easy to kill because of the health. And I think we've struck a pretty good balance there. We also have different kinds of infantry. We have heavily armored infantry that can't be crushed by regular vehicles. But when regular infantry start taking a lot of damage, they duck down, they lay prone, and they take less damage. And your big exosuits, your heavy infantry can't do that. But these big guys, they can't be crushed. They can stand out in front of the tanks, so your tanks can't crush your lighter guys. But we also have systems like the Dynasty Guard. He's the basic infantry for the Tempest Dynasty. When he's crushed, he inflicts the Tempest Charge debuff on whatever crushes him. He's got this little vial of Tempest on his chest that he wears as like a necklace. And when that cracks open when he dies, gives that a big blast of electricity over the tank, and it slows it down and debuffs it. So you can actually mix them into your army as a way to help protect it from tanks. And there's lots of little things like that in the game that kind of make it easier to keep your infantry army alive from being just mowed down by tanks. because we want to have both of these things be interesting and useful.
Do you have special damages, like specific units do more damage to other units?
So I took a bit of a different approach to this. In a game like Command and Conquer, or in a lot of games that are what they call rock, paper, scissors, or what's it called? Well, I'll just call them rock, paper, scissors. My brain isn't working fully right now. Mm-hmm. What you'll have is a unit that deals a base level of damage, and then it gets bonus damage against certain things. So maybe you've got a flame tank, and it does 50 damage, and then it gets a 300% damage bonus when it's attacking infantry or buildings. That makes it really hard to balance. If you tweak it very slightly, it has a huge impact on the amount of damage that it's going to do on the other end. I went the other way. Every unit has a maximum possible damage it can do. And then against certain targets, it will deal half damage, or it'll deal three quarters less damage, or it'll deal 25% less damage. And it's a lot easier to control. I'm clamping on the maximum possible damage and going up to that. It makes it way easier to figure out how much damage something's going to do, how viable it's going to be against certain target types.
But so it's still a rock, paper, scissor, right?
Yeah. So a game like StarCraft, you would call that a soft counter game. If you build enough Marines, they'll be able to kill anything. Theoretically, if you build enough units that shoot guns, you'll be able to take down a building, but you'll still be sitting there for a minute or two in Tempest Rising. So with Tempest Rising, we want to focus both on producing the right units and using them well. Producing an army that isn't good against what your opponent's doing, you're not going to have a good time. But once you have that right combo of units, you still have to outplay them. Now, that being said, one of the other things that I'm trying to do with Tempest Rising is to make it really, really hard to always fight in the ideal way. So just as some for instances, the GDF, they have a buff that they want to use in their army called comms. The idea behind the buff is that they've got some guy on a radio coordinating all the stuff that's going on in combat. And that in game, how that plays out is this buff makes units attack and move faster. And that represents better combat coordination. But what they want to do is they want to have these comms guys out there providing this area of effect that makes their army work better. You kill that comms guy, their whole army is 30% worse. All of a sudden, 30% attack speed reduction. The GDF player not only has to try to get that buff on his guys, he's got to try to keep that whatever's making that alive long enough to make it work. On the other side, the Tempest Dynasty, they have an effect called Tempest Dynamos. Earlier, I talked about distribution mode and how that speeds up your buildings, but it hurts them. Tempest Dynamos is the same thing on units. There are units that have it's kind of like stim packs for Marines in StarCraft. You pop stim packs on a Marine in StarCraft. He takes about 10 or 15 damage, and he moves and attacks faster for a couple seconds. With Tempest Dynamos, it doubles their attack speed, but hurts them the longer they have it on. That being said, the Dynasty also has some good ways to heal their units, but what they're struggling with is I'm going to hurt myself to win the fight, but then I've got to heal myself and I got to keep my guys alive so they don't die. So what we're trying to do is there's a lot of debuffs. There's a lot of things that your units will run out of ammo and they'll have to run away to restock, or they'll have a buff that they can lose. And it's really, really hard to fight at 100% capacity. So what that lets us do is that lets us get away with having a harder counter system, because you have these big linchpin things that can come out that change the whole face of combat with just one or two things happening. And I feel like that gives our combat a lot of flexibility and a lot of depth to it.
So you have a traditional tech tree for in-match progression, but you've also got doctrines. Is this something which you've created? And how do the two systems interact?
So there's actually a couple of different systems going on. First, we talked about asymmetry earlier. Each of the three factions, we're launching with two playable, and then afterwards we're going to add the third faction as playable. Each faction has a different way of teching up. The GDF have these core buildings, these tech buildings that make their whole tech for all their stuff. It improves all their stuff. They have the satellite uplink that gives access to basically tier 2 tech, and they have the data core that basically gives us access to tier 3 tech. and they have to upgrade these buildings to kind of open up their tech toolkit. If they lose one of these, they lose a bunch of tech all at once. The Tempest Dynasty, they upgrade each individual building. So if they want to produce higher tier vehicles out of a factory, they have to upgrade that factory. And then if they lose that factory, they might lose their entire ability to produce these higher tier units. So they both have a very different philosophy in terms of technology. Now, what doctrines are? Doctrines, most RTS have some sort of upgrade system. In StarCraft, you produce the armory, and then you click and you get the attack and damage upgrades. Age of Empires is similar, where the barracks will have some upgrades, and then you've got a blacksmith that'll have weapon and armor upgrades, that sort of thing. In Tempest Rising, that's doctrines. It's completely separate from your tech tree. In the campaign, every mission, you get access to one point that you can spend on a doctrine. In multiplayer and skirmish, you open up the doctrines menu, you choose one, you take some time, it costs some money, and then you get the doctrine at the end of it. Same upgrades, just a slightly different way of accessing them. But that means in the campaign, you're not sitting there and you don't have to research plus one weapons every mission you're playing. You have this kind of persistent progression that builds up over time. The way I like to think of it is build your own sub-faction. So the GDF they both have three trees. It's a little bit like talents in World of Warcraft, where you unlock one and unlocks the next one down. With ours, it's you just keep going down the same tree until you've researched all of them in that tree or as far as you want to go. But with the GDF, they have the comms tree, the mobility tree, and the intel tree. If you go all the way down the comms tree, you get a bunch of stealth units. A lot of your units are invisible until they attack. And that really changes how your army works. You're running around with all these invisible units that your opponent has to worry about popping up somewhere and destroying something, and you can't even see it happen. The intel tree, you get access to a lot. You can bring a lot more high-tier units to bear. You're producing a lot more of them. They're stronger. So that's kind of your like elite specialist army. And then with your mobility branch, this gives you a lot of opportunity to like sneak a base off in the corner somewhere, or you can use support powers a lot more often. So you're dropping a lot more nukes on your opponent, or not nukes literally, but like bombs and doing other nasty things. they have a support power that makes it vehicles in a fairly large area completely unable to attack for about 15 seconds, which can really change the course of a fight. And if you can use that in every fight, that's pretty powerful. And it's mostly a personal thing. It's mostly about how you want to approach the game. And what I'm hoping to see, I consider this to be a long tail thing. Each individual doctrine doesn't change the whole game a lot. One of them might make your buildings build a little faster. One of them might, when your units die, they drop landmines behind. Each individual thing doesn't change you a whole lot. But by the end, when you've got all of your doctrines researched, you have a faction that feels different than someone else who's playing it in a different way. In fact, the specialists and the doctrines are two ways that I'm trying to allow players to customize how they want to approach the game. In the campaign, you have a machinist. He's a named character. He does things in the game. In multiplayer, you can have three machinists if you want, or you can have two machinists and an operative, or you can have three line officers. And an army with three line officers acts differently than an army with three machinists. These specialists have a huge impact on the game, and being able to choose kind of your loadout or which ones you want to bring along really changes how you interact with your opponent.
It sounds like these, with the specialists and with the doctrine, it sounds like this is a move towards making the game more replayable.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, as you learn more about them, you start to appreciate the subtlety. And so the idea is that you don't get all of the depth and complexity of the game all at once. You can appreciate new things as you play and as you learn about it on your own. And I think that's really important to an RTS, is to feel like it's not instantly solved. You have all these little things to dig in through and explore over time as you play it more and more.
I would say that the economy is also extremely simple, and I'm guessing that is so that you could put more focus on the fighting and not like Like, there's not much about the economy. It's almost a tactics game over a strategy game, I guess. It's a lot about, like, the units, how you control them and so on, right?
So I have a pretty strict definition of what a tactics game is versus a real-time strategy game. To me, a tactics game is a game in which resources don't matter. That would be games like Warzone. War Game. In War Game, you have a fixed amount of points. You put that many units on the field, and then over time, you get a slow trickle that you can call more units in. Or Blitzkrieg, where you literally have a fixed number of things on the field. Yeah. Company of Heroes, by my definition, is a real-time strategy game. You build structures, you train units, your resources are incredibly important. Spending fuel on the wrong thing in Company of Heroes, it completely wrecks your game. In Tempest Rising, setting up your basic economy is not difficult. Maximizing your economy and planning your economy is something that players have to pay attention to. Tempest runs out. You can mine it out, and then it always inevitably happens at the worst time, and you complete your economy completely dries up, and you've got to like sell buildings and move them somewhere else and get something set up somewhere else. And so the basic mechanism of interacting with your economy isn't difficult, but trying to make sure that your economy is doing what it needs to do all the time, that requires you to pay attention. And I think that's true. That's what we want in the game, is that we don't want to give you an annoying system to set up. I love Age of Empires, but I do not like playing competitively, because you are building this very long chain of interlocking things, and you've got to build like 100 workers. And if you've got like a couple too many guys on wood and you're not producing enough food, that throws you completely off. And it's a phenomenal game, but that sort of thing can frustrate me in particular. So I don't think it's fair to say that Tempest Rising is a tactics game. You're building tons of buildings. You have a lot of upgrading and researching and expanding and putting bases in or buildings in new places. There's a lot of like RTS-y things that are going on that are actually like things that you would do in any real-time strategy game. But yes, we want to try to keep the...
I was exaggerating. I didn't mean to say that it was not a strategy game. It's like more towards like more focus on the military aspects rather than the economy aspect is what I meant to say with that.
So that I see that I see that as a positive thing.
Oh yeah, no,
half of your army isn't workers. In an average game, you're probably going to have 5 to 10 harvesters, or maybe 12 to 15 in a very big game. And that gives you more room to do more interesting things with your army.
It isn't fire and forget. It isn't a case of you build your refinery and that's your job done in terms of your economy. I appreciate there's levels of complexity, but this is not, and you don't intend it to be a 4X or a grand strategy game. It is a real-time strategy game developed for a particular audience who remember playing awesome games in the early 2000s and the late 90s. So it fits. The economic model that you have fits with the design tenets and fits with what you set out to achieve, which is to make, as we said before, rule of cool, fun before anything else, really. You've set out to make a fun game. The economy is important, but it doesn't. And we've had a conversation in the past about fun versus realism. That's one of our episodes, fun versus realism. And this is fun over realism. No one's looking at Tempest Rising thinking this is not a mill sim. This is not a grand strategy.
Yeah, you'd
game.
Be...
This is about having fun.
You'd be surprised.
Playing a game.
We have tried to strike a careful balance with that, where it's not too cartoony. That's something that people leverage against games a lot. Where they say it feels like Fisher-Price, it feels like a mobile game. We wanted the game to take itself seriously, but also be over the top. And I think that's also kind of a very like 90s, early 2000s thing, where it takes itself seriously, but it's not like Rambo. It takes itself very seriously, but it's not an actual, a realistic portrayal of what's like an action movie.
And it's very action-packed as well. Like it's very action-oriented.
Yeah, what I like to say, and I got this from one of my friends, And I hope you hear this and know that I got this from you. I feel like what we're trying to do is respect the player's time. There's a lot of games where there's a big, long setup period. And conversely, there's games like Command & Conquer Generals where you can be absolutely destroyed a minute and 3 seconds into the game. So we wanted to both not give people a bunch of busy work, but also to keep things moving and to keep things from stagnating or feeling like it's a slog. We didn't want the game to feel like a slog. There have been matches that I've played and I'm like, I'm sure this has been a 40-minute game. And I look up and it's been 18 minutes or 20 minutes. And it's because we don't have a lot of actions that get in the way of doing what you want to do. And I feel like that smoothness, you can feel that when you're playing. I hope people agree with me that it feels good to be able to go in and just keep doing things and keep iterating and keep working towards your strategy without a bunch of stuff in the way.
Yeah, actually, you mentioned that the resources can run out. I imagine at some point you encountered the thing of like, oh, both players have now mined all of the resources. Both of them don't have too much to do. I imagine you must have thought of that. So I'm curious about your ideas on this.
Yeah, I'm glad you gave me a chance to come back to that. Because when I said Tempest runs out, there's more to it than that. Tempest actually works like a plant. So it starts with what we call a root node. That is the core of the plant. It's a big vine that's growing up out of the ground. Some Tempest fields don't have them, and when they're mined out, they're gone. Nothing happens. They don't come back. Most Tempest fields have what we call a small root node, and that root node sends out vines, and the vines grow pods, and then the pods allow more vines to grow, and so on and so forth, until it grows back. And then once those pods grow, they can mature over time and grow larger and bear more fruit and become more valuable. So if you completely mine out a Tempest field, it will grow back over time. And there are some games where you can keep mining a resource patch that's run dry. Like in StarCraft, a Vespene geyser, it will still give you a little bit of Vespene when it's empty. Or some games ask you to switch over to a secondary economy. Like when you run out of gold in Age of Empires, there's still generally other ways to generate gold. But Tempest just grows back. It just comes back. And if you mine it slowly enough, it'll never run out. And there are other fields that have what we call a large root node. It's a bigger root that grows back much faster. So it's actually more valuable long-term to control one of these fields. And in the game, there are some places that aren't valuable at first, but then as the plant grows, it becomes valuable. There's some places that are really valuable at first because they've got a bunch of Tempest there and you mine it out and then it's not valuable anymore. And then there are some where it's cyclical, where you mine it out, let it grow back, mine it out, let it grow back. And this is where the depth comes in. And this is another thing where you can learn over time, where the map tells you, just based on where these resources are and how they regrow, what to do. I can go here and harvest all this resources real quick, but then it's useless to me. Or I can go capture this, let it grow, let it mature, and then it'll serve me for the entire rest of the game. And this prevents us from having to find a way to force a player to switch over to a secondary economy. It's all about situational awareness and the ecology of... I'm going to coin a term here, the ecology of economy. but we really like the growth patterns of the Tempest plant are fairly complex, and it gave our programmers a big headache when we first had them implement it. But I think it's really paid off dividends because it really adds to the interest of the game without giving you a bunch of systems to learn. You can just look out there and see the thing growing, and then you know it's valuable, and you can go get it. And when it grows back, you can go get it again.
So we've talked in the past on our podcast about a strong single-player experience, and you're launching this game with two full campaigns, 11 missions each. How much weight do you place on the single-player experience?
I will answer your question, but I want to say one quick thing first. We are launching what we think of as a very traditional RTS product. We give you a campaign, actually two campaigns. We give you Skirmish, and Skirmish is really important to me. There are lots of times where I go into the game and I want to play Skirmish, and do I go into multiplayer? Do I go into single player? Is it a custom game that they add bots to. That's become a lot more common lately, by the way. It was very important to me that skirmish is front and center in our menu. You go in, you see skirmish there, you can click it and go right in. And that's important to me because a lot of people don't just play one RTS game forever. They go into a bunch of their favorites and they cycle through them every couple months. If someone comes back to Tempest Rising 15 years from now, wants to play skirmish, they will know where to find it. It is right there in the menu. But this comes back to me saying that what we wanted to do was go back to the roots of the genre. We wanted to say, we're going to give you a strong campaign that you're going to care about. We want to give you a skirmish that challenges you. And we want to provide you with the, we think, important experience of being able to do fair multiplayer on a ladder. And we also have taken the additional step of doing a quick play. So you get all the benefits of matchmaking without any of the stress of having to worry about your matchmaking rating. I would say we have done the most work on our campaign. We feel like telling a good story, having a good experience, making it replayable. We've talked about doctrines and how every mission you get an extra doctrine point. That's 11 doctrine points. That lets you replay the campaign with different doctrine setups. I think you actually, there's an achievement for beating it without using any doctrines. We have another system that we haven't really talked about yet called equipment. So every mission, if you do, if you complete the mission, you get a resource called requisition. And if you do the side missions in the campaign level, you'll get bonus requisition. And you spend that requisition on equipment, and you can load that into a loadout and bring that into the mission. And what that is stuff that we didn't feel like was suitable for multiplayer. So you have like napalm grenades, and you have rockets that can shut down enemy infantry's ability to attack, and you have all your drones get switched out with lasers, or your infantry auto heal. They have all kinds of fun little things that you can add in there. Actually, one of my favorites is Tempest Ammunition. It makes all of your infantry, all of your rifle infantry, inflict Tempest Charge on enemy tanks. And it takes 5 stacks of Tempest Charge to introduce Tempest Overflow. If you've got 10 guys, you're just mowing down tanks with your infantry. It's hilarious. But you can play through the campaign multiple times using different loadouts, using different doctrines. And we feel like that introduces more replayability. But we really wanted to tell a good story. And our level design team just goes over these missions over and over and over again, trying to make them better and clean them up and make them more interesting. And we actually we brought in a focus group of players not that long ago, and they were doing like surveys after each level. They got passed off to the level designers. So I would say we put a lot of energy into making sure that the campaign feels good to play and is interesting and gives you the challenge that you're looking for. We released last year a demo with the first and second missions of our campaign, including all 4 difficulty levels. We've got easy, medium, hard, and insane. And we had pro gamers like StarCraft 2 players who were not able to beat the second mission of the campaign on insane the first couple times they played. You have to figure it out. It's a lot more challenging. And I'm not saying every single level is going to be like that, but we're trying to make it the insane difficulty actually challenging to people and interesting to go in and try to figure out how to make it through the mission.
Brandon, we're getting towards the end of our time, so I've just got a couple of things to ask you, which you can answer very, very quickly. So the first one is, how much can you tell us about the vetting without getting into trouble?
Well, by the time this airs, people will already have had a day, and I'm sure several of them will have already been through the campaign in that time. The Veti are the source of human mythology. They draw from, or they are the inspiration for angels. They have a unit that actually looks like a biblical angel. They're the inspiration of the Vedic manuscripts. I don't know if you are familiar with the Vimanas that are mentioned in ancient Hindu literature. They actually have a unit called the Vimana. It's a giant flying castle. The idea is that all over the world there are stories that have come down from these ancient aliens that lived on Earth, and they came here to harvest Tempest, which naturally grows on the Earth. It's not an alien thing. It's something that they came to Earth to get. And their relationship with it is mysterious. A lot of their origins are mysterious, but they view the Earth as theirs. And the human war kind of wakes them up, and they're like, okay, well, back to it. We're going to enslave everybody again. But yeah, they literally view humans as livestock. And when humans wake them up, they get right back to the it's like if you owned a farm and you woke up and you had a bunch of cows and horses fighting in your field, you'd be like, well, time to put a stop to this. in the beginning, you'll see the Veti really view the humans as basically a nuisance that has to be tolerated and dealt with right away.
It sounds like they're right, because we are a nuisance.
I didn't say they were wrong, did I?
One final question for you, Brandon. And this is a nice, easy one. What's your favorite unit in the game?
That's not an easy one. That's like asking me who my favorite kid is.
Well, okay. I have a favorite kid. You have a favorite kid. Just don't tell the others that you have a favorite.
No, I actually do have an answer for this. One of my absolute favorite units in the game is called the Shield Maiden. It's a GDF unit. It's tier 2. It's really a support unit. I don't like units that just do one thing. In Command & Conquer, there are anti-air units, like the GDI Slingshot, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. All it does is it hits air units, nothing else. I decided I was going to make one of those. So the Shield Maiden can only attack enemy air units, but it does two other things. First, it has something called the Missile Interference Aura. Any enemy unit that shoots a missile attacks 60% slower when it's inside of the Missile Interference Aura. That doesn't sound like a lot, maybe, but it is huge. Being forced to attack more than twice as slowly as you normally do is a really big impact to enemy units that shoot rockets. And the Dynasty in particular love rockets. So they actually have to adapt to having a couple of these on the field, because it really interferes with their DPS to have to deal with attacking into this Missile Interference Aura. The third thing that it does is it can drop repair turrets. Now, the GDF are very potent. They have a lot of really good, cool abilities. What they are really, really bad at is keeping their army alive. When their infantry take damage, they pretty much have to load them inside of things. If you're garrisoned inside of something, you heal over time. So the GDF, their barracks is actually a garrison, so they can load guys inside of that and they can fire out. They have the riot van, so they can load guys inside the riot van and have them heal. Their engineer can put down these little turrets, these little guard towers that they can load there. But it's micro-intensive. You have to remember to put your guys inside these things. The Shield Maiden, when it drops the repair turret, it gives you a huge area of repair for your vehicles. Otherwise, they have to send their vehicles back to base to be repaired on their repair pads. So I feel like the Shield Maiden is a really interesting unit that gives you a lot more options, and it makes your opponent really have to think differently about how to fight your army.
So the Shield Maiden's your favorite?
I think so, yeah. Definitely one of my favorite units, easily.
Okay, well, Tempest Rising launches next week, the 24th of April is when the game comes out, and you can visit tempestrising.com to find out more and go to Steam. Link will be in the description of this podcast, and on YouTube will be there as well. Pre-purchase the game or stick on your wish list for when it's released on the 24th. And if you've got any thoughts on today's episode, or just want to tell us what your favorite RTS is, we'd love to hear from you. So head over to thecookandmovespodcast.com for all the ways to get in touch. Brandon, thanks very much for coming to talk to us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I hope you can go and have a fantastic evening.
You guys too, and I know it's really late for you, and I want to thank you guys for hanging out with me so late in the evening.
It's been a pleasure, mate.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming on and speaking to us.
And thanks for your time, gentlemen. Have a great evening. It's great talking with you.
Cheers.
Thanks very much. Take it easy. Goodbye.